Hello, in this podcast, I'm going to give you a tour, a walk back in time to when mankind, or humankind, first put electronic gadgets together and made light or made radio waves. This is the creation between 1886 and 1889 of radio waves by Heinrich Rudolf Hertz. That's Hertz, which is used in the commemorated in the unit of frequency we have at the moment. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. As usual, I've become fascinated by areas in which the school books or its teaching has actually missed some major points and have actually instructed more misinstruction. An instruction. So previously, in previous podcasts, I've looked at the poor old electron configuration, where there is a tendency at schools for people to teach electron configuration in terms of the shells 2, 8, 8, 18 rather than 2, 8, 18, 36 with the infilling. They've just ignored that because it's much easier to do it that way. And similarly, I've just done a podcast on the Maltese cross, the demonstration of electrons, where an old mistake has been woven into the teaching, where electrons emerge like a searchlight from that large disc rather than from in your glass tube. You'll have to go back and listen to the podcast if you want to see this a bit or hear this in a bit more detail, rather than from a little point source, and all the physics and the beautiful physics and observation has been swept aside. So in this case, I'm going to try and take you on an audio journey back to 1886, at the time of Heinrich Hertz. He's a 20-year-old, or late 20s, physics professor, trying to get his doctorate, and he's under the guidance. In Germany, they know. He didn't actually stumble across this. In Germany, they know that perhaps if you produce a circuit, theoretically it should produce a radio wave, and theoretically it should be polarized. That is, if you've got polarized sunglasses, you can actually get rid of glare or look at the sky. You can look at polarized light, you'll be able to turn it. And so he was looking, his aim, it was assumed that he'd be able to produce radio waves. And were these radio waves, did they behave in a form of polarization? Did the actual full electromagnetic theory, which is just written on paper, if I built a circuit to produce it, would that actually hold up and prove it? And this was called the Berlin Prize. So there was a prize, like an X Prize, that this PhD candidate, who is going to become a professor, and die, so I should say that he died, I think, at the age of 36. I've sort of read at various points that it was from a skiing accident, and more recently I've read that it's a genetic disease that he had, which meant that he'd just progressively get sick and die at 36. So this is a young, bright spark, and if you read his work, he's a very gentle person. Unassuming person, unassuming German. I think born in Hamburg, which is northern Germany, and basically stuck along the Rhine. He did a lot of his work in Bonn and Karlsruhe University. The actual labs, I'm not sure it was, but I've read descriptions of the labs and looked at the descriptions of the instruments. And this is sort of very much a different approach that you have, that you come into the classroom, the science classroom, you open the book, and you look at the diagram, and half the equipment isn't there. And you look at the videotape, or the video presented for what's going on, and it's got no correspondence to the actual experiment going on. In actual fact, the effects have been faked going in, and you can't say, look, this is wrong, because the your fellow teachers have been teaching this and for years, and so this is very offensive to them to say, oh, this is wrong. So we're not going to try and convince them. We're going to try and take you on a detailed journey into back to 1886, a time where the equations were written up, and people were saying, well, hang on, this must mean this. It's that if I produce a particular circuit, we'll produce it. So the major thing missing in the textbooks is that they have a spark generator. I've forgotten what the actual term is. It's named after a German scientist. It's a little high-voltage spark generator. And we'll have to start off with that, because this is where school and history separates each other. High-voltage spark generator is a high-voltage generator. I've forgotten the name of it. It's just on the tip of my tongue, unfortunately. But basically, it's a electromagnet, a self-induction coil, it's called, if you want to look it up. And there's a DC power supply, which powers a central electromagnet. And that electromagnet generates a magnetic field, and that magnetic field pulls a lug, which breaks the circuit. So it's got that characteristic, bah! It's like a clatter thing. It's a typical buzzer. It is actually technically a buzzer, but the buzzer operates by the circuit breaking. Now, this magnetic field has the current suddenly broken off, and this means that the magnetic field closes down, and you have a pickup coil on the outside, hundreds of wires of pickup coil on the outside, and it's the rate of change of magnetic field which determines the voltage on the outside. And this is hooked up to two wires on the outside and a big like lovely spark gap. And the spark gap can be, it's generally just rule of thumb, 10,000 volts per centimetre, just roughly. I'm sure there's better numbers for it. And so your spark gap can be 3 centimetres across, from a little spark to one of these button discs that people tend to like. And the spark goes from your spark electrode across, and this big spark goes across. Now, at school and in the world, that's radio frequency generator. The actual radio frequency, many people believe the radio is produced by that visual spark. You can see that spark. Well, that's electrons jumping, and that's generating radio waves. Now, if only that was so, and obviously you can see here that when lightning cracks in the old AM radios, you could hear it crackle. I think, I don't know, the old AM radio on TV, you could actually watch aircraft fly over, because the radio signal would bounce off the aircraft and into your radio signal and form a ghosting pattern. So as an aircraft flew away, you'd see these ghosts in the old cathode ray tubes. This is back in the good old, even in the 80s and stuff like that, when you're out here in Australia. So often we'd have very sort of long distance radio transmission, and this is very much what's going on. And so we have to go from the misconception that these sparks and the sparks generator are sufficient. And what Heinrich Rudolf Hertz did was he hooked it up to a capacitor and induction circuit. And if I can draw a mental picture of them, I just have to work out the actual scale of it, just in my head, just doing the calculations. I think it would be 60 centimetres, a ball, a coil of wire. Now, a coil of wire, as you know, is a bit of an electromagnet, and we call that an inductor. So what happens is that you have current go into this and generates magnetic field. The magnetic field creates a back EMF, and this the mechanical analogue for this in electricity is a mass. And on the surface, at the end of this, is a sphere, and the sphere acts as a one electrode a capacitor. So as charge can build up in a cloud or a balloon, charge can build up on a one electrode capacitor. And I think there's also two electrode capacitors used in this called Leyden jars. I don't know the exact, I see different pictures of it and I do basic calculations of it, but a Leyden jar is basically a jar and you put silver foil on the inside, it's silver foil on the outside, and that creates a large uniform capacitive surface. So a capacitor is basically two plates where the charge on one plate pulls charge onto the other plate, and so you can actually stores charge having two plates. And so this is the negative charge would like to get to the positive charge, but it's stopped by a piece of glass or a vacuum gap, and so you can actually build up charge in a capacitor, because the electrons will, or the positive charge will draw electrons, and it will stabilize and will store charges. So you have the two, and the equivalent of that, if you can imagine, is like a spring. And indeed, the mechanics equations for a swing or a car, shock absorbers or anything mechanical, oscillating pendulum, marry right across to electronics. But for capacitors you use springs, and for inductors you use masses, and for resistors you use a shock absorber or a damper that obviously, as current goes through a resistor, it dissipates out in heat. So a shock absorber dissipates oscillation energy out like that. So we've got these components built up. So we've got a sphere, a coil, a spark gap. Okay, don't get confused. Another coil, another sphere. And that's capacitor, inductor, spark gap, inductor, capacitor situation is a basic radio transmission antenna, a very primitive one. And to get radio transmission, there is a few books, and it is hard graft to get through it. Essentially, you have to have an electric field displaced over physical space, because a radio wave isn't displaced over electric space. And normally when an electric field changes, the current changes, it can create a magnetic field, especially in this case, because the wires connecting these fields were in loops going down this loop. It did create a magnetic field. Magnetic field. Now, the art of this for any dipole antenna is to get the magnetic field and the the electric field in synchrony. So basically, if the magnetic field is out of phase with the electric field, the energy gets stored in your system. So it's sort of like you hit a bell and the energy oscillates inside it. But if you get it to the right frequency, it will actually begin to radiate the magnetic field. The A pointing vector will escape. And that's my best way of describing it. I'll have to get back and reread electromagnetic radiation and convert my mathematical understanding to a physical description. But I do have a sort of on the cusp of physical description. Bear in mind, don't get angry at me. There is no physical description in the textbook of why a radio antenna should operate at a particular frequency. So you, by actually getting the resonant frequency, the important thing is the resonant frequency It pumps very well at this resonant frequency. So like a bell or a chime, you hit it, it will go at this resonant frequency. You also shape it that it actually creates a lot of energy. So you can actually say, I suppose, have a metal bar and hit it, but if it's actually shaped as a musical instrument, it can produce a lot of sound and a resonant box, so to speak. That's, I think, the best way that I can describe it. So the important thing is that Heinrich Hertz was... everyone knew what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. He was producing a resonant chime, radio chime, and he was hitting it with a high voltage. So this buzzer would buzz at low frequency, say, buzz probably 10 times a second, 30 times a second. It would produce 20,000 volts plus volts as a spike. And obviously that spike will have Fourier components, frequency components at every frequency. But he wasn't actually interested in doing that. So he used the spike and connected the spike up to one end of this split antenna. I hope that my description is good at this stage. So if you can imagine a ball, a coil, another little ball, and a spark gap and a ball. And so this would be put up at 10,000, 30,000 volts at high voltage, and as a big pulse, this would suddenly brought up, and the circuit would be such that the current wouldn't flow, the voltage wouldn't flow back. It would, in preference, actually see a breakdown gap between the spark gap and actually go and start to pour into the bottom receptacle, which is a coil and a capacitor. And if you can imagine, the capacitor is acting as a spring, and the inductor is acting as a mass, an inertial mass. So the initial capacitor shoves the electric charge down, and then it keeps on going because the capacitor starts to push it along, and it pushes along, builds up a charge, and the induction builds up on the opposite end, and most of 99% of the electricity at the frequency that it likes to will go opposite and go up and down. Now the frequency of this was around 400 megahertz. So that's 400 million times a second the electricity would go from the top to the bottom through the spark gap. So you'd have a short spark that is a fraction, a small spark at your electricity generator. It would go across to this device and it would go up and down on, say, thousands, millions of times. Even if it did millions of times, it would be less than a millisecond of frequency generated electromagnetic radiation. So this was producing a very pure frequency because it had a capacitor, inductor. It was all... Oh, and you can get the frequency simply by... I think it's 1 on F equals 1 on LC. This is just going off the top of my head. It's L, the inductance times the capacitance gives you the frequency. So he built up the capacitor and the inductor, and he could measure simply by doing a capacitor of a sphere is a certain capacitance, an inductor, a coil of a certain number of coils over a certain amount of coils, basically, free space coils, a certain inductor. And so he could put this in and say, well, I've actually wound it up like this using a sphere of this size. This will have a frequency out. And the idea of his spark gap here was a switch. It's the switch allowed the electricity to get in, and then it would have the path of least resistance. So if you'd like it, it's like a blow valve, a pressure valve, so to speak. So once it's finished, the switch would switch off. So your spark gap in the centre was not the source of radiation. And so I think a whole heap of people think that the spark is the actual source of radiation. It's the high voltage going up and down. Now, dare I say, I think that was a dipole transmitter. They've got other transmissions. Today I still marvel at these very small mobile phones. How much supercomputing has gone in to actually produce a mobile phone antenna of that frequency? That's a slightly higher frequency. That's at 10 centimeter radiation, but nonetheless, mobile phones are something to really admire. So let's go up that Heinrich Rudolf Hertz in 1886 to 1889, that thing began working on the Berlin Prize, and he was producing from his high voltage transmitter pulse source, going pack, 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 that pack was going pack, this process, and you can imagine it starting off. I've chirped that, but the actual volume would drop down, so you can imagine this spark coming off. And to this day, I have not seen a recreation of the 100 Hertz apparatus in which there is the radio transmission. And indeed, in textbooks, people, and exams and stuff like that, people just show the voltage transmission. Now, this voltage one will produce a spike, and the spike will go off like a lightning bolt at all frequency. He got the power of that spark and actually made a single frequency, around 450 million hertz. Now, light travels at roughly 300 million meters per second. The moon is 400 to 300 million meters away, or 1,000 kilometers away. So the light travels to the moon in 1 second. And so something at 1 hertz, a radio frequency at 1 hertz, would have a wavelength from the Earth to about the moon. Something at 300 megahertz, that's 3 by 10 to the 8 meters, 300 million meters, 300 and megahertz, will have a wavelength of roughly 1 meter. So the frequency times the wavelength equals the velocity. If the velocity is 300 meters per second, and the wavelength is 1 meter, the frequency is 300 meters per second. So 300 hertz per second. Now, let's just do a little aside here on how you write hertz. Hertz, the SI unit. Hertz, the SI unit, is capital H, then a small z. The reason that you have two letters for it is that H is also the unit of a Henry, I think. The Henry, I love that. The Henry is some sort of unit of induction, I think. I really can't remember. So H is taken up, so Hertz has to be HZ. And it's also good because it gives you a bit of clue. H, you don't know what that could stand for. HZ, you know, oh, that's Hertz. But in writing, if you write about the bloke, Hertz the bloke, it's capital H-E Hertz. But Hertz the unit, if I say 10 Hertz, H-E-R, TZ, it's a small h. So if it's a unit like Newton or which is also someone's name, or Hertz, someone's name, it's actually, and you're writing it as a unit, because it's a common name, it's a small letter. So I think we've got that out of the way. And we've got the radio generator, the spark generator. the radio wave generator, and the radio wave is producing something around 400, 450 hertz. It's at roughly 75 centimeter or 0.75 meter wavelength. So that's the pure wavelength that's been produced by it. And bear in mind, at this stage, the school textbooks, teachers, and all that stuff has just dropped off the important frequency generator. In fact, they've just shown you, they in general show the voltage generator and then have an AM radio and say, oh, look, this is our recreation. And I think this is actually a mandatory prac. So throughout New South Wales, everyone has to actually demonstrate this prac. And the demonstration, I don't know. So you can imagine. So overseas, I don't know if you're doing this as well. So out here in Australia, little bits of the textbook have disappeared, and we've trailed off recreating this experiment without the actual key piece of experiment. Now, Hertz was no fool, and he decided that he was, rather than actually have the radio waves travel in all directions. And this is pretty important here, that from the detailed descriptions of the labs, you realise that the labs are largely wooden buildings. So there's no, and there's not a lot of electrical interference going on here, because there's not a lot of radio waves production, because we haven't got a lot of equipment producing this type of stuff. Okay, so if you can imagine, there's not a lot of electronic noise. The world has not become electronic, so he's producing it here. But nonetheless, he produces a parabolic dish, and the parabolic dish is in the dimension. So the oscillator is vertical, and he has a dish which is vertical, and this dish concentrates the radio wave energy. Now, we're used to radio waves travelling, I don't know, kilometres, sometimes around the Earth. If it's a ham radio wave, you can hear the Aussie birds going around here. You can hear the Australian outback here, the odd person with a power tool, and various birds. Okay, getting back to them. So we have the voltage generator, the radio wave generator, and a parabolic dish. You've got a parabolic pickup. Now, people said, and this just blows my mind, he had a pickup radio circuit with a micrometer spark gap. So micrometer spark gap be about a volt. Micron will be just roughly off the top of your head. So if he got the spark gap small enough, so in the textbooks they have a brass ring with two brass knobs, balls on either side, and he said, well, he adjusted that to a micron. So you can imagine a heavy brass ring with two brass balls on the edge. So the brass ring is a ring. You cut the ring open and you pull the ring back a bit and you put two brass balls on. I'm asking you to imagine it because that's what we are asking students to imagine when we give them this diagram. So, and they said he held this up and I've got some big news for you at the end of all of this. This is sort of like the punchline. I do have a punchline for this, so you may as well keep on listening. And the idea is that you would hold this ring and you could orient this ring such that it was a vertical ring or flat, horizontal. If it's horizontal, it no longer picked up the electromagnetic radiation and proved everything. So the Berlin Prize, I think, came and went, and Heinrich Hertz, beautiful soul. If you read his work, he's just a really gentle unassuming, nice guy. He didn't realise the importance, a lot of the importance of his own work. But he was, he was just generally not. I actually like him as one of the 17th century scientists. 19th century scientists. And so this ring, you can physically imagine it. It's a brass ring, of course, and you can pick it up, and you say, my own experience is that these things, these electromagnetic things, one of the major problems is that you yourself become part of the circuit, and you'll know this if you're picking up, I've been doing circuits where I've tried to get away from radio waves or produce measuring picoammeters. And one of the things, if you touch the wrong piece of equipment, you are a huge radio antenna yourself, and you just swamp any signal. So I was very skeptical. Oh, what can I say? And there's heaps of black art to measuring picoamps. This is another thing. I've been measuring incredibly small currents, and there's a real black art in terms of capacitors and washing parts and hooking up things together and selecting cables. It's huge black art in it. And as soon as I saw the diagram of this brass ring with brass balls on it, I said, how could that possibly work? Because if you touch it, if you do anything to it, it will completely go. I just cannot imagine how that works. But, we've got to teach students to draw this in an exam, draw a brass ring. But so it turns out, if you see the actual diagram, something very much different is done. Instead of a ring, he's got basically a recreation of his transmitter as his receiver. And his transmitter is two balls with an induction coil between the two. His one is not a ring, it's actually a spring. It's not a brass ring, it's actually a spring. It goes across, and it's actually hooked in a circle, but the circle is mounted on a cross, like a Christian cross. And the spark gap, is built onto this wood with a vernier micrometer, which can actually bring in the spark gap precision. And so what that means is that he has something which measures the voltage, transmitted voltage induced in his receiver, which is this, not a ring, but a coil in a circle. And I'm sure it's on the internet somewhere. Don't go to textbooks, go to the actual source. And this ring will, and if you look at it, will produce a micrometer space. Now, just to give you an idea, a width of paper is 50 micron, if you're lucky. 50 micron. So, down to micron, you can resolve the biggest thing that you can resolve visually is 5 micron. Again, if you've got good eyesight and 20/20 vision and a good lens, is 50 micron. So this is, 5 micron. So this is holding something at fairly close. I can't do it now. My eyes have, I need to wear glasses to resolve 50 micron. Now, albeit a spark, you can possibly resolve, because you will get it'll be a change in colour, so your eye will, a change in brightness, your eye will tend to pick this up. But nonetheless, I would say that it would take several months of training to actually, if you wanted to recreate this, several months of training. Now, let's go through Hertz's experiment. So, just to summarise, the schools just show the voltage generator. In history, we've got the radio wave generator, the parabolic dish, parabolic pickup dish, and a receiver which is different from what's drawn on schools. Rather than a brass ring, it's actually a coil and a micrometer gap, which is set them. So he can actually adjust it. And if he adjusts it to 5 micron, that may be 5 volts picked up. 10 microns is 10 volts picked up. So he can actually adjust this and actually use this as a fairly fine procedure. And so when he can adjust the polarization of this, so polarization is basically if I've got a skipping rope and I can go in the vertical plane or horizontal plane, it's just like the radio waves. So in the production of here, I've got a linearly polarized light source. So not only do the people know that this would generate electromagnetic radiation, it's just by looking at the polarization effect, there were so many effects that were proven with this apparatus, is that it was actually a clanger, that this was, we're definitely sure that this is really, there was nothing to see here, move on. Yeah, everything's okay, let's move on. In fact, that's what Hertz thought. Oh, look, I've just proven what's been proven, you know, what we expect. There was no sort of sense of great moment in history. We've sort of recreated it. And so Hertz did a series of things. I think he had a series of parallel wires which absorbed the light. He had various prisms. He had radio waves reflected off piece of metal. So it's sort of like a mirror. You know how if you hold a mirror at an angle, you can get a double image? He was able to switch his radio source into a double image radio source. And that double radio image source is sort of like Young's slit. It's called Lloyd's mirror. It's sort of like the cheats version of Young's slits. Having one of Young's slits look like it's in a mirror between the two. So the expanding waves from one slit hit the mirror and bounce back, and they start to interfere on each other. So he measured the wavelengths on there, and everything checked out. So he knew the frequency. And he got the distance, and the speed of light is given for you in the numbers of Maxwell's equation, and that's there. So he developed a series of experiments which produced there. Now, one of the things I have seen is people with this spark generator try and do interference experiments, and you go, what? You're not producing a particular frequency. How are you doing it? I've seen other people get one spark generator and put another spark generator next to it sufficiently close that the voltage actually leaks from one to the other, hold it across, very highly dangerous stuff, and one spark generator will induce another spark in the other generator, and it'll hold sufficiently close, complete, I suppose, hocus pocus. I've also seen a science education video where they've just faked the distance, and the effect is obviously indoctrinating teachers in the belief of it. So look, the punchline is that after years, given that the actual strict high definition version of what's going on, there's two punchlines. So after years, a lot of what exactly was done and the complexity and the understanding was required some sort of appreciation. And of course, if you're reading this and not teaching it, you develop your appreciation and then do the teaching, you sort of come up from it. After years, people have tried to reproduce this experiment, and they haven't, as far as I know. There's no one who has said, here is a reproduction of the experiment, here's the experiment redone on. You can imagine if someone actually did this experiment, they'd make a YouTube video And I might be proven wrong. That would be good. Be interesting. I would put my hand up as being very fascinated to see it. But no one has actually reproduced this experiment. The people have come close with a lot of effort. But there are still things we really don't know. It's a very subtle experiment. And these people, just on the verge of going... And again, why would you? Because you've got radio transmitters, satellites, the whole world has boomed up from there. But it's very interesting to go back in science, and it's also interesting to see how the complexity of... There's a lot of weight in this, a lot of things to understand. I suppose the interesting thing is that you've got a highly tuned single frequency out transmitter. The detector is also designed such that the same frequency in the induction and capacitance is the same frequency in going in. So there's a lot of design here which has been lost in time. So the actual there is an inspirational point in history and science. It's very important that the first time we've got down on paper, the first time where people have put the ideas together, and it's a very clean way of teaching it, because you can say electricity, well, people don't have the dipole antenna, but electricity, electromagnetic radiation, I don't know how it's done, how you teach it without the E field, the capacitor for the E field, and the inductor for the magnetic. I don't know how you do it, but that's a great point in history. But again, there's not a lot of people recreating it, even though it's a mandatory experiment. It's mandatory that people produce this experiment and do some sort of demonstration associated with it, yet there is no evidence, or no strong evidence, of people easily recreating it on the original experiment. And quite frankly, the original experiments would be quite involved, quite expensive to produce. Now, there's another piece of science, and I'm not going to say that what's written in textbooks are wrong. It's just unlikely. Okay, so the micrometer spark gap, it's measuring the voltage at high frequency. Given these have got no computers, no oscilloscopes, nothing here. You've got megahertz, there's no equipment even remotely close to deal with these high frequencies. And so the spark gap is this beautiful way of measuring the voltage at high frequency, because the size of your gap is how many volts it is. It's sort of this beautiful thing you can do. It's a really, really beautiful thing. And this is, it was a standard piece of lab equipment. The story goes is that Hertz, given that this is a qualified piece of light equipment, couldn't see his spark in the dark, but required some UV light to actually interact and generate some fast first electrons of the of this effect, and so I think it's a HSC teaching point down here. Report the photoelectric effect that Hertz observed but did not report. Now, my overall thing is that if you actually do experiments of the photoelectric effect, one of the things you do have to do to get the photoelectric effect to work is you have to polish your metal, remove the oxide layer from metal for the photoelectric effect to work. And what you typically do is you charge up an electroscope and you shine UV light on it, nothing happens. You polish the surface of the electroscope, get the aluminium down, polish the aluminium off it with a grit and a paper, so it's nice and shiny. And then you charge it up with your charge rod. This is a little, it's got a dial and a leaf in it, and you charge it up, and the leaf, the charges go down to the leaf and expand at an angle, and the angle measures the amount of charge. And what happens is you work on your UV light, and wow, the electrons are moved off. Now, whether that would be sufficient in the dynamics to make a spark, is there. So you've got this piece of story which has gone in. It's not written at source. And you say, oh, look, I'd like to go back and check the source. This, did he actually note this in his papers or anything like that? And the actual story is sort of a maybe, maybe not, that there is no citation process to actually verify this teaching point through your science, standard science process here. But there is a story. Again, I can't... I read it before I was teaching, but this story where in Germany he had this is Heinrich Hertz, had a capacitor on the bench, and he held it up. I'm not quite sure, this is just my memory. He went out to lunch, and a beam of sunlight came in through the window and shone on his capacitor. And when it shone on his big capacitor, the capacitor discharged and light went off. And he was able to note that sunlight hitting a capacitor causes it to discharge, which is very similar to what you do. And it sort of says certain things about the quality of capacitors and the equipment, that it was a freshly made capacitor with no... oxide build-up for it to be made, and he observed that. And I don't know how this is written down or why this is through, but there is this remaining story somewhere in the literature of this incident, the side incident. Now, what's really hard to go is to say, right, he observed that. And that's there's some written down, but not written down in his key experiment is this UV light going in. Now, again, this is the point of I suppose textbooks and citations. The textbooks do not have citations, so it's very hard to pick up. It just I've got my suspicion in that there's an event in which he has seen the photoelectric effect and observed it and noted it down. And there's another event where he's got the precision capacitor, and it just seems very unlikely. It seems that so the murkiness of the story has come through. Let's summarize. This is a Peter Hill Explains, and I'm explaining from a viewpoint, and I'm deliberately explaining what's taught in Australian schools. And it's not always. Some of the diagrams have some of the capacitors and the transmission, radio transmission source put up there, but that's sort of it's not as strongly put. So there's this misunderstanding basis that the high voltage spark pulse generator is the radio transmitter. And now what I've done, hopefully in this podcast, is actually taking you back in history and talked you through, and I don't know the ability of my descriptive powers are there, but talked you through. So you've got point A, what's taught, and point B, a much more subtle, rich complex thing to actually teach, and obviously that has to be re-refined into some teaching points. And of course, people who've it's a minefield to go through as students to go through. I've got my son doing the HSC, and I'm not discussing it with him at the moment. But if you take yourself away from getting correct marks in exams, it is something very beautiful to pick up. I suppose the things that I've picked up, the social things, besides some general interest in and improving my understanding of electromagnetic radiation and reinforcing some of my understanding there, I've picked up a gentle, nice period of German, of scientific history this is. The complexity now that we sort of now know why Hendrik Hertz died at 36. A window into the advanced scientific understanding. We understand how he died. We are now living in a world where there's radios and Bluetooth and wireless everywhere. So there's sort of a window between now and then, which is a beautiful thing to reflect and to think about the experiments and the equipment there. That's one aspect to go across. And then we have this other weird, weird world doing things, doing experiment and convincing people that this is the experiment, and with the idea of advancing their understanding and actually not doing the actual real experiment. And that's, again, a profound thing. You know, I just want to give you an example of, you know, people will say, oh, well, that happens all the time. What I want to do is talk about a few things very similar to it, where things are enacted, but they're no longer relevant to actually what's happening. So in the Vanuatu, the Solomon Islands, you have the cargo cult. So during World War II, around the Coral Sea, the Americans began to develop air bases. So the very first contact with the West were these American soldiers coming along, and the various Americans would say, "Hi, I'm John from Idaho. I'm John from Dakota. I'm John from Wisconsin." And so the natives listened to this, and they said they created a god, and the god's name was John Fromm. And it took a while of anthropologists to go back, where is this John from? And it's the John from the different places. And what they would do is that the Americans came and said, well, we're building an airstrip here, and out of the sky would come planes and supplies and food and plenty. So after the Americans left, they actually built airstrips and would do drills. They would watch the American drills and actually construct things and hope things would come through. So this is a religious ceremony, and this is called the cargo cult. Look, I really do ask you to look this up, the cargo cult. So there is this feeling that these experiments that we do, which actually don't actually do the actual mechanical things, the actual processes to go forward, but we've actually taken them up in ceremony, is a bit of the cargo cult. I just want to say one other story from the Australian Army mapping. So this is in Papua New Guinea, which is north of Australia. So there's this mountainous region, and very early on, after World War II, probably 60s, even 70s, there are these tribes or lands. There was contact there, but the Australian Army Mapping Corps would go up there, and there's lots of stories here. They go up, patrol up, and they said, the first village they came to, they got out and they said, look, we want you to clear this region here, build this in this way, and this is a helicopter landing pad. There's, I think it's pidgin English for helicopter, they'd seen helicopters before, and they said, this Australian Army helicopter's going to land in your place, but you have to clear the jungle and produce this landing pad. And so they dutifully did this. But when the helicopters came in, there wasn't just one landing pad. There were 30 or more landing pads, as the information had been transmitted up to all the other villages, and all the other villages up there had also built landing pads as they came across. So this is a bit different, but this is sort of the understanding of the information, but not sort of understanding the deeper context of it, this beautiful view. And so we're down here in the South Seas, reproducing Heinrich Hertz's experiment without the actual radio oscillator, and I hope that's entertaining for you, but it also piques your interest in looking at this and looking at the beautiful complex work. These people were not at the 1886 Germans were not by no means stupid. They had a really good, perhaps better understanding than I'll ever have of Maxwell's equations and building devices, and built these beautiful, beautiful devices well worth seeing. So that's all for the moment. This is a long form podcast. The objective here is for me to get confidence in podcasting and talking, as my cardiac rehabilitation getting ready to go back into the classroom, and also to build up a store, and also to produce longer term, longer form podcasts for people to listen to. So I'll say, well, I'm trying to aim for about half an hour each. So look, thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science and keep on looking things up. Please look things up, as I've done, and read ahead. Thanks. Bye.